It's a bug's life.
There's something called the Grand Slam, which are four highly endangered butterflies that every really obsessive collector wants. And one of them is called the Queen Alexandra from Papua New Guinea. And it's totally illegal to buy or sell. The habitat is very endangered. And they go for $8,500 to $10,000 a pair.
That's Jessica Speert. We'll talk with her about her book, Winged Obsession, The Pursuit of the World's Most Notorious Butterfly Smuggler.
A lot of people have written, write about animals, but they tend to write about animals that are, sort of readily humanized, let's say. Insects are like, they're like almost like the limit case of animals. And I wanted to try to figure out how to think about them and maybe even to just understand them better.
And that's Hugh Raffles. We spoke with him about his book, Insectopedia, at the Orion Magazine Book Awards ceremony, where he received the top prize. And we'll also hear about a poetry program at the Frost Place, as in Robert Frost. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. The illegal wildlife trade brings in $15 to $20 billion a year, selling huge numbers of animals from endangered species to collectors. Of this market, the illegal butterfly and insect trade brings in $200 million annually. It's not just disaster for the animals. It also is contributing to the extinction of species that pollinate our fruits and vegetables and are key indicators of environmental stress. This illegal trade provides a lucrative living to the smugglers who supply the goods to their insect-obsessed clients. Jessica Speert followed one of those smugglers, Yoshi Kojima, a.k.a. the Hannibal Lecter of the conservation world. She also tells the story of the man who hunted Kojima down and brought him to justice, Ed Newcomer of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. It's a fascinating tale Speert spins, as you'll hear. Jessica Speert writes about wildlife law enforcement, endangered species, and the environment for magazines ranging from National Wildlife to Mother Jones. Well, Jessica Speert, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Your book, Winged Obsession, has two protagonists who are perfectly matched to each other. One is Ed Newcomer. He's an agent with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And then there's Yoshi Kojima, the Hannibal Lecter of butterfly smuggling.
Right.
Tell us first about Newcomer. You start the book with him as well.
Sure. Newcomer was a rookie agent at the time that this story actually took place. He had wanted for many years to be a fish and wildlife agent. He had started out as a lawyer, and it took him quite a while to be accepted, and he reached it right before the age cutoff. And he was so excited because he really wanted to work with, the animals that are really endangered and the larger animals like elephants or tigers or chimps, the real charismatic animals. And as his first case, being a rookie case, he, of course, was handed something that nobody else in the office would want to do, which is working with bugs and butterflies, going after a butterfly smuggler. So it was really, really interesting the way he got into this, especially because he was also afraid of bugs. He doesn't like bugs. And he really had to throw himself into this case, and it was fascinating the way he went about it.
Now, he was uniquely suited to this job in spite of the fact that he didn't like bugs.
Yeah, I mean, he didn't know how suited he was, really, until the whole thing started rolling. He was given the assignment to go to the L.A. Museum of Natural History during a bug fair that takes place once a year there. And Yoshi Kojima usually showed up as a vendor. He's a Japanese national who lived in both L.A. and also back in Japan. And a dealer had complained about Yoshi and had offered to become a confidential informant, to be wired up. And Ed's job was to go and babysit, basically watch the CI at work, make sure he had backup. As the CI went and spoke to Yoshi, tried to engage him into conversation and develop a relationship with him. And the CI had gone over and was speaking with Yoshi and eventually went back to his own booth. He was also selling insects. And Ed got bored and started wandering around the fair and eventually worked his way over to Yoshi's table, where he began to ask Yoshi questions. Yoshi, as usual, was surrounded by collectors. They would gather to him like bees to honey because they knew that Yoshi always had the best, most beautiful, hardest-to-get butterflies. And Ed started asking him some questions, and Yoshi turned around and found Ed very engaging. Ed actually looks younger than he is. He looked like a young boy. He looked like he was in his late 20s and very clean-cut. And Yoshi found him to be very nice. And before you know it, they started developing a relationship. Ed said he wanted to learn about bugs, about butterflies, that he wanted to get into the business of selling butterflies. And Yoshi offered to teach him what he knew and to go into business with him.
Yeah, this is just amazing. Now he wasn't completely going into business with Ed Newcomer. This offer had some hidden agendas to it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, very much so. What it turned out, in this case, Yoshi is such a paranoid guy, and he's so difficult. The case almost crashed and burned twice. But he really, it wasn't just this wonderful offer, magnanimous offer of, oh, I'm going to teach you everything that I know, and you'll work with me, and won't this be wonderful? It was basically that Ed was being used as a patsy, where Ed was going to be his liaison here in the States. Yoshi was going to go back to Japan, and Ed was going to be the one putting up the bugs on the photographs on eBay, the one that be fielding all the offers, and if anything happened, if anyone were to get caught, Ed was going to be the patsy who got caught, and he knew he was being set up.
Now, you say get caught.
By Fish and Wildlife for selling illegal butterflies. I mean, the thing was they were going to start out with legal butterflies on eBay, start getting people in, and they would soon learn the real collectors who wanted the illegal butterflies. Illegal butterflies are ones that are highly endangered. And Yoshi either traveled around the world himself, and he also had set up a network of catchers, of natives around the world who would capture certain butterflies or butterfly eggs for him. There's something called the Grand Slam, which are four highly endangered butterflies that every really obsessive collector wants. And one of them is called the Queen Alexandra from Papua New Guinea. It's the largest butterfly in the world. It's what's called a bird wing. Gorgeous, gorgeous butterfly with a wingspan of almost about 12 inches. It looks like a bird when it flies. And it's totally illegal to buy or sell. The habitat is very endangered. They're impossible to captive breed. And they go for $8,500 to $10,000 a pair. And they're basically an icon for the butterfly world and for endangered butterflies as much as pandas are for the World Wildlife Fund. And so these were the kinds of things that once they started getting collectors that they knew were interested, then they would begin offering butterflies that were endangered or threatened that you needed paperwork for that Yoshi never had paperwork for. So it was a whole shell game that was going on in a sense. Ed was definitely the one who was going to get into trouble if anything happened. Ed was going to be the one that was going to get hit by Fish and Wildlife. He was the one that was going to, if he had been just a regular person believing Yoshi, that would end up going to jail for all these drawing people in with legal butterflies and then begin offering them the illegal stuff.
And, of course, this was the perfect setup. He couldn't have been handed a better situation. But it wasn't. It didn't turn out to be quite so easy. But before we go on to how this relationship, this remarkable relationship between Yoshi Kojima and Ed Newcomer, how that developed, I'd like you to take a step back and tell us about this butterfly trade. How serious an issue is the trade in endangered and illegal butterflies?
Well, it's really interesting. This is something people really don't realize, and it's butterflies and also bugs. It's huge. It is. They estimate that it's $200 million illegal trade a year, which actually is a small part of the entire illegal endangered species trade, which, according to Interpol, is $15 to $20 billion a year. But it's still quite a large amount of money. And what's really interesting is people go, butterflies, who cares? You know, big deal, butterflies. What people don't realize are butterflies are very much an indicator species of what's happening on our planet, in our environment. And they're also a pollinators of food plants, food sources, second only to bees. If the same thing were happening to chimps, pandas, rhinos, elephants, as happens to butterflies, there would be a huge outroar. But this has been very much an unknown subculture of collectors for a long time. And what's interesting is this book has sort of brought it to the surface and made people aware. And a lot of those very obsessive collectors are not happy about it. They've been getting away with a lot for a very long time.
Yes. We're talking with Jessica Spiert about her book, Winged Obsession, The Pursuit of the World's Most Notorious Butterfly Smuggler. Now, obsession is the theme of this book. These butterfly smugglers are so obsessed that it almost seems as if they're like gamblers, that it's a kind of sickness.
Well, it's interesting. I did talk to a number of obsessive collectors, and some of them very freely spoke to me. One man who actually is an entomologist, lepidopterist, works at UC Riverside, openly admitted that his wife, anything else, comes second to butterflies. Butterflies have ruled his life. It's what he's obsessed with. Another obsessive collector that I was put in touch with, who would only speak over the phone, wouldn't meet in person, began to describe a lot of obsessive collectors, and he said, not only, he has Asperger's, and he said a lot of the very obsessive collectors also have Asperger's, where there's such a focus, a very definite focus. But on the other hand, what makes it interesting is they have a very hard time with relationships with people and with women. And this one obsessive collector who spoke to me was saying that he desperately wanted a girlfriend, would like to be married, just couldn't really relate to women. And what he considered his butterflies were his harem of females.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. It is interesting. And then I spoke to people when I went over to Japan. I spoke to some collectors in Tokyo. And one was going every summer with a friend of his. They would actually hire a small army of guys to go with them out into the forest and the jungle, go out to Cambodia and to Burma and go collecting very, very rare butterflies. And there are people who get so caught up in this that honestly they will spend so much money, they will just take days off work, take sick days, go off collecting when it's butterfly season. They end up being fired, losing their homes, losing their wives, losing their, you know, everything. And, I mean, this is obviously extreme cases, but this is how caught up people really get into collecting butterflies and bugs.
And so this is a kind of a perfect setup for someone like Yoshi Kojima to come in and to operate with utter impunity. You know, we do have an Endangered Species Act, but you say that the enforcement has all the clout of a wet noodle.
Yeah, it does. With the Endangered Species Act, if you get caught, basically you're charged with a misdemeanor, which is pretty much a slap on the wrist. You really don't get jail time. With that, you need a felony charge, and that comes under the Lacey Act, which is much more serious. You need to bring in things like endangered species or threatened, whatever, you know, illegal, going from state to state or from one country to another without any permits that you're smuggling in. Yoshi got caught because he was doing that, also because he had fake custom documents. He was misusing the mail service. He was sending stuff in through express mail, international express mail, and documenting it as something else. Those are much more serious charges. That's where you get your jail time. And, I mean, that's the problem with the endangered species trade, is nobody takes it serious. And even then, when you get the jail time, as you know, Yoshi got 21 months. That's a lot for a wildlife violation. But when you think about the trade and the enormity of it, I mean, they're saying that the illegal wildlife trade comes after a drug smuggling and human trafficking. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the same people who deal in all those illegal things also deal in endangered species because they know it's a slap on the wrist.
Wow.
So you really need much harsher penalties.
It seems we're going in the opposite direction.
Yeah.
So now tell us about Yoshi Kojima. He is a fascinating personality here, this Hannibal Lecter of butterfly smuggling. I mean, he really is a very unsavory character.
Yoshi is fascinating because he's unsavory, and at the same time, when you first meet him, he can be very charming. But what he ended up telling me, nobody has ever had much information about Yoshi, and I was able to interview him at one point. And what he ended up telling me is that as a little boy, in Japan, there is a huge reverence for nature and for insects. They love it. Insects, people keep them in their home. They're more popular than cats and dogs. And little boys, as they're growing up, will go out into the forest and they'll collect beetles and they'll bring them out. And they'll have these little fights with beetles, you know, little like putting them on the ground. And it's a game. And Yoshi would go into the forest and he would collect bugs and beetles. But what he would do is he would kill them. And he would begin to collect them. And his father evidently had been a butterfly collector and knew a lot about this and taught Yoshi a lot. Yoshi ended up going to the University of Osaka, getting a degree in entomology. Very, very knowledgeable man. He also developed an obsession for butterflies and bugs. Except he also had a true love for money. And he really got into the trade very full time. And he began to learn the art of smuggling, which fit his purposes perfectly. He had been over in Hawaii after he had graduated from college and working at a convenience store. And the Yakuza, a lot of Yakuza were over there traveling through whatever. And
The gangsters.
And they were making these 8mm porn films. And full frontal nudity, real pornography is still, believe it or not, taboo in Japan. And they wanted to get in these, they wanted to smuggle 8mm films into the country. They were going to sell them on the black market, make a lot of money. And Yoshi was approached and asked if he could figure out a way for them to get it into the country, somehow slip it in. And he, very, very clever guy, looked around the convenience store, saw these packages of chocolate-covered macadamia nuts. And he very carefully slit the cellophane, removed the box, threw away the macadamia nuts. The box fit 2 8mm reels of film. He put it back in the cellophane, ironed it closed to seal it. And these guys, the Yakuza, would hand carry it in shopping bags, looking like chocolate-covered macadamia nuts, back to Japan. And this went on for a couple of years before customs caught on. But by that time, Yoshi had learned how to smuggle and begun to make money and realized this is a pretty good deal. And so he started getting into it.
He loved the money. He was fascinated by the insects and loved the life of someone. He loved the life of illegality in some way.
He did. He was the one who said, "I'm the world's most notorious butterfly smuggler." He said this on a tape to Ed Newcomer. And I even joked about it with him. And he laughed and said yes. He'd like to describe himself as the Indiana Jones of the insect trade. And at one point, Newcomer, when he was undercover, had said to Yoshi, "Oh, someday they're going to make a movie about you, Yoshi." And he was all excited at the idea. He loved the notoriety. He loved being popular and the guy that everybody came to and knowing that he could get what nobody else could get.
We're talking with Jessica Spirit. Her book is Winged Obsession, The Pursuit of the World's Most Notorious Butterfly Smuggler. He started getting obsessed also with Ed Newcomer. Talk about the evolution of their relationship and what began to happen.
This case was fascinating because when Ed first met him, this was a time Ed couldn't even get an undercover phone. I mean, this is how strapped Fish and Wildlife was a few years ago, still is. But because Yoshi couldn't reach him, the case pretty much crashed and burned the first time. Yoshi wants attention. He wants to be able to have 24/7 attention. He wants to know he can reach you whenever he wants and have you on his string for as long as he wants. And he got annoyed with Ed. Case sort of crashed and burned, got resurrected a second time, and then also a third time. The third time it did, when they finally really connected, when Yoshi had come back to the bug fair and Ed managed to, you know, bump into him at the bug fair, they reconnected. And this time, Ed made sure that he was readily available for Yoshi. And Yoshi said, "You know what, I want you to get onto Skype. We're going to Skype when I go back to Japan." And Ed thought, this is a great deal. Kojima could show him the illegal butterflies on Skype. He'd be able to tape the whole thing. He'd have evidence. And they began to Skype. What he didn't realize was that Yoshi had started to develop a crush on him. Yoshi was gay. Ed didn't know that. Ed wasn't sure what Yoshi was. Yoshi always made jokes about various things, but he thought maybe it was just Yoshi's sense of humor. And slowly but surely, Yoshi begins to come on to Ed more and more and more during these Skype calls, to the point where he begins to demand that Ed do certain things, that Ed undress. And of course, Ed, this is a fine line. You can't do this as an undercover agent, you know. And Ed is married, very happily married, straight, the whole thing. And Yoshi became more and more demanding. And the only way Ed could play this, he realized, was first of all by not getting upset about it, being very cool about this whole thing, and kind of leading Yoshi on, like, you know, why don't you come back to L.A.? I owe you some money for these butterflies. Why don't you bring some of them? Yoshi had begun to ship things over to Ed, so Ed was getting all this illegal material, documenting everything that had come in illegally, but he had to get Yoshi back into the U.S. in order to arrest him. And so it was, you know, when you get here, we'll have our date. Oh, I'm not doing anything, Yoshi, until you come here. It'll be, you know, this is the big surprise when you come here. Oh, there'll be such a surprise for you when you come here. And it was sort of this cat and mouse game that began to be played of how far do you go, when you cross the line into entrapment. And the thing was, Ed was very clever about it and very good and very careful because he was a lawyer, and he knew exactly how far to push it and when to pull back. Yoshi's downfall was a love of money, a love of butterflies, and lust for Ed.
And so he does, as you've alluded to before, he did get arrested, but it was pretty touch and go.
It was very touch and go. It was unbelievable. When he did arrive, when he flew over, first of all, he said he was flying over at one point, and he really didn't. Evidently, he would put out stories to make people think he was coming at a certain time, so that if Fish and Wildlife, because he was always very aware that Fish and Wildlife was after him, he would set them off into a different direction. You know, he wouldn't be there when he said he was going to be there, whatever, in case somebody were to blow information on him, like, Yoshi's coming in this day on this airline. So he was doing that. It was driving Ed crazy. There had been a whole blow-up between them. He'd gotten very upset with Ed because he began to feel that Ed wasn't available enough for him once again, and he was very jealous. He was very suspicious. And finally, Ed learned that he was coming into the country at a certain time on a certain airline, like 2 hours from this moment that Ed learned about it, and he ran to the airport, and all the alerts were in with customs, so that if Yoshi came back into the country, immigration would stop him. They knew it. Stop this guy, he's going to be arrested. All the alerts were in place. And whatever happened, something happened when he came in. Everybody got off the airline. He was never stopped by immigration. He walked right through the gate. Ed was panicking. Customs was panicking. There was a mad dash searching for this guy. He was almost out the doors and gone of the airport. By the time they just managed to see him, and Ed got him arrested.
And what a moment, what a shocking moment, of course, for Yoshi, because he thought he was pretty good at sizing people up, and he had, in fact, suspected Ed of being an agent, and then his suspicions were allayed.
Yeah.
What was it like for Ed to arrest Yoshi?
Ed actually did not do the arrest, because he wanted to be able to try to get some information, and he was afraid that Yoshi would clam up.
Well, that's true, but later on he did.
Oh, later on.
Yeah,
you know what?
When
he finally confronted Yoshi with the truth of who he was, for Ed it was a good time. Ed had reached his limit with Yoshi. He wanted to finish this case. He wanted Yoshi put away. Yoshi had driven him so crazy, and understandably so. It was a moment where he said this was it. It was almost, in a sense, a cold feeling of like, yep, this is who I am. Yep, I'm married. Yep, I fooled you the whole time, Yoshi.
So you did get to meet Yoshi yourself. What was your feeling when you came face to face with him. What did you think of him?
Well, it was very interesting because Yoshi, he was in prison in California for 21 months. And the whole time he was there, he refused to speak to any press. Nobody knew about him. He'd formed this web of lies. He would never speak to any press during the time he was in prison or after. And I, like Ed Newcomer, had become obsessed with Yoshi. The more I researched this book, the more I knew I had to meet this guy. And I knew there was no way I was going to email him or call him up and say, "Hey, Yoshi, I'm writing a book. Can I come talk to you?" And I knew the only way I would get to him would be to go undercover. And what made it interesting was I didn't know anybody in Japan. I don't speak Japanese. I didn't know if Yoshi would be home because Yoshi always traveled the world. I just knew I had to go. And so I went over there. I did go undercover as someone else, and I managed to bump into him through a series of means. It was actually hard getting to him, and I thought I wasn't going to get to him. But I did manage to bump into him and befriend him. We spent time together going for coffee, going for dinner, talking quite a bit. My impression of him when I first met him was this is a very charming man. He was one person who was really nice to me in Japan, and he knew a lot. This guy knew so much about butterflies, and he also let me know early on that he had been in jail for this, and he said, "You should Google me. I'm very famous." So he also had a major, major ego, but he was nice enough to me that I began to feel really guilty about what I was doing. I was there. I was fooling him. I wasn't being honest about who I was or what I was doing. And I thought, oh, my God, how can I do this to this guy? And it was only the last night I was there, when we went out to dinner, that he suddenly started saying to me, "Do you know how to use eBay? I would love to sell my butterflies on eBay." This is the same line he used with Ed Newcomer. And Yoshi very much knows how to use internet auction sites because he's on them all over the place. But he didn't want it. He wanted another patsy for here in the States. And I suddenly sat there, and it was just this amazing realization of, yeah, we're not friends. And who's conning who? And the tables were suddenly turned. And that's when I went, okay, I'm okay with this.
Jessica Spirit, it's been fascinating reading this book, Winged Obsession, The Pursuit of the World's Most Notorious Butterfly Smuggler. Thanks so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Francesca.
Jessica Spirit writes about wildlife law enforcement, endangered species, and the environment. You can read an excerpt from Winged Obsession by going to writersvoice.net. And the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, so crucial to bringing Yoshi Kojima to justice, may itself become endangered due to the budget deal just concluded in Congress. There's a link to more information about that at writersvoice.net. Next up, we talk with Hugh Raffles about his book, Insectopedia. Stay tuned after the break. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. The number of insect species comes in at somewhere between 6 and 10 million. They might actually constitute more than 90% of the animal kingdom. That doesn't stop many of us from recoiling when we encounter them. That was once also true of my next guest, anthropologist Hugh Raffles. Writing his award-winning book, Insectopedia, was partly a way for him to overcome his discomfort with bugs. And the more he learned, the more his wonder and appreciation grew. Raffles communicates that wonder and appreciation in eloquent discursive style in his book, Insectopedia. And the editors at the environmental literary journal Orion thought so too. They gave him the top prize in their 2011 book awards. I traveled to Brooklyn, New York, to talk with Hugh Raffles just before the awards ceremony. The ceremony took place in March, right around the time the Fukushima reactor had exploded in Japan, releasing huge amounts of radiation into the atmosphere. It's still doing that. It was much on my mind, so I started out by asking Hugh Raffles about one of the people he highlights in his book, an artist who discovered something important about the effects of radiation through her work. Hugh Raffles, in this book, we don't have a whole lot of time here to talk about it because you're about to actually do a reading on the occasion of you winning the Orion Awards. So I'd like to just zero in on really two questions. One is, I was really struck by a chapter that you have in the book, and that is where you interview this marvelous scientific illustrator, Cornelia, maybe say her name?
Cornelia Hasse-Honegger.
Right, from Switzerland. Tell us about her work and what she discovered.
Yeah. Well, Cornelia was a scientific illustrator who worked in a lab, a genetics lab in Zurich, where flies were being, fruit flies were irradiated. And so she got very familiar with the kinds of disturbances and deformities that the flies would have after radiation. But she was also something of an amateur insect collector and was very fascinated by collecting tiny little true bugs or leaf bugs in her garden, in her yard, in outside Zurich. And she started to notice deformities that correlated with or were very similar to the deformities that she was seeing in the lab. And she started to think about radiation. This is going back nearly 40 years ago now, so she's really been doing this for a long time. So what she started to do was to visit nuclear power stations, and Switzerland is supposed to have the cleanest nuclear power stations in the world. And she was visiting those nuclear power stations and collecting, sort of downwind from the power stations, collecting the same kind of bugs, these little true bugs. And she'd find this very high incidence of deformities. So they would have shortened, one antenna might be short, their wings might be deformed, some kind of physical, physical changes. And she'd collect these and she started to document what she's convinced are high levels of deformities connected to the low-level radiation that these animals are receiving from being downwind of nuclear power stations. She also traveled to Chernobyl and Three Mile Island and various other more famous places and discovered the same things. She had a tremendous amount of difficulty over the years, over the decades, in fact, of getting anyone to pay attention to her work. And that's one of the things that I wrote about that was very fascinating to me. Some of that was because she was a woman, clearly. Some of it was because she wasn't an expert. Even though she knew these insects probably more intimately than anybody else, she didn't have the credentials that would make her, formally a scientist. So she wasn't able to have that to back up her research. So what she really wanted to do is to just get the attention of scientists and say, look, please, pay attention to this. Something is going on here. And even that she had tremendous trouble doing. It's only really recently in the last few years that people have started to pay attention to her work.
Now, one of her great discoveries, one could say, is that, well, there's a lot of talk, what we hear in the news going on around now with the reactor in Fukushima, that there are safe levels of exposure to radioactivity. And what she discovered is that actually the deformities far from the plant at where there are low levels of radioactivity are about the same as they are around the plant.
There's a group of scientists who are convinced that the curve that is used to measure radioactivity, which is an exponential curve, a linear curve, which says that there's a threshold for exposure above which radiation is dangerous. There's a group of scientists who really challenge that as a model. That the evidence for that linear curve comes from tests that were done after the bombs were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, when people went in, scientists from the Army primarily went in, the U.S. Army went in, and they monitored radiation levels. there's a group of people now who think that that curve is actually a very poor way to judge the effect of radiation on individuals, because our cells go through cycles. We have different vulnerabilities at different points in our life, at different points in a cell cycle, depending on how we ingest the radiation. All these kinds of variables which don't get taken into account if we just have a straightforward, you know, this is a threshold, this is above the threshold, this is below the threshold idea of what dangerous exposure is.
And what's so interesting is that she also, Cornelia discovered this also through her art. And that's one point that you make. Talk a little bit about how art and her unique vision was able to discover something that the so-called experts weren't.
Yeah. Well, Cornelia talks, you know, she's a painter. I mean, I said that she was a scientific illustrator, but what she's been doing for the last 30 years is, as she's found these insects, she's been painting large-scale, what are effectively, I suppose, portraits of them. And she says that often she doesn't see the deformities until she looks at the painting. And she talks about painting as a form of research, and it's because you're paying this very, very close attention to this very, very tiny, these are very tiny animals, but paying this very close attention to them, that as you're painting them, you don't really notice what you're doing, because you're really, or this is how she describes it, because she's really focused on, you know, on line and shape and color. I mean, very intensively engaged with it. And it's only when she steps back and sees what she's painted that she sees the condition that the animal is in.
Now, another question I had was, you write, this is a very beautifully written book. It's also written, it was a style that struck me in some ways in the same range as one of my favorite authors, W.G. Zabald. Is he an influence on your writing?
Very much so, yes. When I, you know, this book took me quite a long time to write, and when I first started writing it, I'd been reading a lot of Zabald. Yeah, I like his writing style a lot, and I like the kinds of moods that he creates. I'm more split about the kinds of melancholy that is so important in his work, and the sense of loss and memory that is, you know, so strong through his work. And although I share some of that, I'm also not, I suppose because I didn't have the same experience, I haven't had the same experiences that he's had, I'm not so caught up in that particular mood.
Well, you're very playful, but what struck me was also about what was similar to me was kind of the, I think of it as like being a flaneur through what you're looking at, all kinds of discursive, you know, going down different pathways to think about the same thing.
Yeah, and I admire his work a lot, and there's, I don't know if you're thinking of... What's the book where he travels through East Anglia, and it's like a walk, and that book actually I thought a lot about that, and the way that he can take you from a detail, and without even realizing it as a reader, you can suddenly be in a completely different time and a completely different place, and everything can suddenly be really expanded in the space of the same sentence. There's something almost magical about the way that he can do that, and it's lyrical but very grounded at the same time. And I really admired that and thought a lot about how, you know, just the ability to create that kind of movement within a text. Yeah.
Yeah. And so now you've won the Orion Award. Was this something you even knew about beforehand, and were you surprised?
Well, I'm a reader of Orion, so I knew about the award. But yeah, of course I was surprised. I had no idea, and it was really not just unexpected, but, you know, it's very exciting and a great honor, and you know, I admire Orion a lot, and that they were able to think about nature, but not in a, you know, have people who write about nature, but who really write about the ways that people and nature are so entangled and so caught up in each other, so that, you know, so much of nature writing is as if nature is out there and something separate from us. And I think they're very, very serious about having us think about all the different and complicated ways that we're so mixed up with nature, so that really, I mean, I would say nature doesn't even really exist independently of us at this point, you know, that we're just we're really, you know, we're obviously we're part of nature, but in you know, for better and worse, we're all in this together, I think.
And so that kind of intimate vision is also what informs your wonderful book, Insectopedia. Would you like to just say anything about the writing of the book for us?
Well, as I said, it took me a long time to write. And It was quite, and I think maybe it feels like this when you read it, but it was quite an intense experience writing it. And when I started it, I wasn't particularly, I hadn't really thought much about insects, and I wasn't an insect lover. But through writing the books, I mean, saying intimacy is a really good way to put it. I mean, I feel like I developed this real intimacy with insects through meeting people and talking to people who had this, who had those kind of relationships, and really learning a lot from them. So the book for me was very much a sort of, I mean, it really, I mean, I know a lot of people say this, but it really was a sort of exploration. You know, I really, maybe that's why I know a lot of people said it feels very open-ended and very sort of opening in that way. And I think that's because I was really learning as I went along. I didn't really have any strong agenda to make. I was really just trying to figure stuff out as I went along. And maybe that's some, that made it exciting to write as well, because it gave me a lot of freedom in the writing, because it wasn't that I really had this strong argument that I wanted to make. I just really wanted to try to find things out, and sometimes writing in one particular way seemed to match the subject better than another way. You know, I felt that I had a lot of, it was a very fluid kind of book to write, I suppose, and that was great. I liked that.
And so if you didn't really like insects beforehand, why did you pick this subject?
Because they were so difficult. Because I felt like I really didn't understand them and I wanted to know more about them. And because a lot of people have written, you know, write about animals, but they tend to write about animals that are, you know, sort of readily humanized, let's say. Insects are like, they're like almost like the limit case of animals. And I wanted to try to figure out how to think about them, and maybe even to just understand them better. And I actually don't think I understand them any better. I know a lot about them, but I don't think I understand them better enough. But I like that. I like the way that they're sort of ungraspable. You know, that's sort of exciting, that you can spend so long with something and still feel that actually there's more and more and more that you don't know about them.
The book is Insectopedia. Hugh Raffles, thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice, and congratulations for winning the Orion Award.
Thanks very much, Francesca. Thank you very much.
Hugh Raffles teaches anthropology at the New School. In addition to Insectopedia, he's the author of In Amazonia, A Natural History, which received the Victor Turner Prize in Ethnographic Writing. Shift gears now to talk with poet Patrick Donnelly. He's leading a program for advanced poets starting August 7th through the 12th at the Frost Place in New Hampshire. It's where poets from around the country come to participate in summer poetry programs. Donnelly came into the studio to tell us about the Frost Place and its programs for poets.
The Frost Place is a museum and poetry conference center in Franconia, New Hampshire, at what was once Robert Frost's old homestead there. He lived in the house on that property from 1915 to 1920, and he also spent 18 or 19 summers there. And he wrote some of his most enduring poems while he was living in that house. And since the 70s, there have been poetry conferences and other programs there. And right now, there are three summer conferences there. There is a conference on poetry and teaching, which is mostly directed towards high school and middle school teachers, helping them to incorporate poetry more into their teaching. And then in July is a conference called the Festival and Conference on Poetry. That's run by the poet Martha Rhodes. And, oh, I should have mentioned that Baron Wormser runs the the conference on poetry and teaching. And then I direct a conference in August called the Advanced Seminar. And the Advanced Seminar it's for more experienced poets. It's for poets who have been through workshop and they know about workshop etiquette, and many of them have advanced degrees in creative writing. Some have published in literary journals. Some have published whole books. So it's for maybe a little more experienced poet. And what we're going to try to do, we are organizing things on the theme Choosing Our Poetry Parents. And the idea of that is that every writer is working with some models, you know, perhaps consciously, perhaps unconsciously. But during the conference, we're going to try to make that very conscious. Like, who did we choose to be our poetry parents?
And, oh, who's your poetry parent?
Oh, gosh. So hard to name, but absolutely Walt Whitman, Yeats, Frost himself. So, you know, during the conference, we're going to try to make this very conscious and also ask ourselves, you know, we chose these parents for the writing we did up to this point. How is that working for us now as poets? Or do we need to choose new poetry parents to take us forward into new writing?
It sounds like a really exciting program. I'm curious about even the first one, teaching poetry to teachers in middle school and high school. What are some of the challenges do you think that teachers face in teaching poetry? And what have you found being connected with the Frost Center? What are some of the challenges that teachers are telling you?
Well, that isn't my program, but I can tell you that I have worked with young people briefly. I was poet in residence at Gardner Pilot Academy in Alston in November of, was it last year? I think it was last year, for 3 weeks. And that was my first time working with young people. And it was a big challenge. You know, you have to translate what you know about craft and helping people to write poems into a language that young people, in this case fifth graders, could understand. And, you know, I remember coming up through school that some of my teachers incorporated poetry and some of them were quite good at it, and you could tell that they really cared about the poems and understood them and that they meant a lot to them. And then others, there's a kind of picking apart phenomenon where I think Billy Collins calls it strapping to the poem to a chair and beating it. You know, it's like there is a way of teaching poetry that can kill it for kids because it just makes it seem like a mechanical or a mysterious thing, you know. What I tried to do when I worked with the fifth graders was to show them that some poems that were saying things that they could identify with, that expressed feelings that they might have themselves. And so we would use sort of springboard poems like William Blake's The Tiger. Mm-hmm. We read that poem as a springboard. Okay, if you were going to write a poem about an animal, about an animal's qualities that you wished you had, first of all, what animal would be and what quality do you wish that you have that you could borrow or steal from an animal? And, of course, they just ran with that, you know, because kids are very imaginative. So I think it's a matter, I mean, nobody should teach poetry who doesn't love poetry. I guess that would be the first rule. And I think what the Conference on Poetry and Teaching does, first of all, the teachers who come there are themselves writing poetry. So they already do love it. So it's just, it's about pedagogical techniques. How can you introduce poems to young people in such a way that it can help them live their lives, you know, just like all art, really, you know, painting, dance, film, everything that we turn to help us go through a difficult world, you know. It's, yeah. I think that's what art is all about.
And so then moving to the other end of the spectrum, the poets who are already experienced, that's your program. What are you planning?
I have tried to assemble a really diverse and exciting faculty. I wanted poets whose poems I admire, you know, because you want somebody who has something to pass on. And the second thing is I want to create an atmosphere for a conversation, because it's not just the faculty, you know, talking at the people who come to the Frost Place. It really, with poets at that level, you need to have a conversation as among peers at different levels. So I think it was Hemingway that said writing is a craft at which we are all apprentices and never become masters. And that's the way I look at my own teaching. Even if I'm working at a beginning poet, I always think, let's solve these problems together, not I've solved all of these problems and am now going to tell you how to solve them. No, I will be your companion in helping you to figure out what the problems are and then how we might solve them. So what I'm hoping will happen is that we will have one of those wonderful conversations where you sit up late at night with people who care about the things that you care about, and that people will say things to each other that would not have occurred to you before you came into that conversation. You know, one of those charmed sort of circles of luminous conversation. That's what I'm hoping will happen. So,
you know, so if people want to get in touch with you and learn more about this, if they're hearing this after this year's conferences, they can still get in touch with you about next year's, and they might be hearing it even beforehand. So where would they go?
Well, we have a website, of course. It's www.frostplace.org. And you can also be in touch with us by email. It's frost@frostplace.org, just as though Mr. Frost were still living there, like that was his email address, frost@frostplace.org. And also, if you just Google The Frost Place, you will find us very quickly. And there's descriptions of all our summer programs, and we'd love to have people apply to be our resident poet at a kind of early stage in their career, maybe having published one book, maybe between the first and second book. That's how it's worked for the last 30 years, and we've had some really stellar resident poets. And I'm happy to answer anybody's questions, too. You can write me at patricksdonnelly@aol.com.
That's great. Now, you have actually a poem about the Frost Place. Would you like care to read it for us?
I do. This is by William Matthews. He was one of the resident poets at the Frost Place, and he went on to become quite a famous poet. And he's in this poem kind of wrestling with living in the house where Frost lived. It's like he's wrestling with Frost's shade in this poem. On the porch at the Frost Place, Franconia, New Hampshire. So here the great man stood, fermenting malice and poems. We have to be nearly as fierce against ourselves as he, not to misread by their disguises. Blue in dawn haze, the tamarack across the road is new since frost, and 30 feet tall already. No doubt he liked to scorch off morning fog by simply staring through it long enough so that what he saw grew visible. Watching the dragon come out of the notch, his children used to call it. And no wonder he chose a climate whose winter and house whose isolation could be stern enough to his wrath and pity as to make them seem survival skills he'd learned on the job, farming 50 acres of pasture and woods. For cash crops, he had sweat and doubt and moralizing rage, those staples of the barter system. And these swift and aching summers, like the blackberries I've been poaching down the road from the house where no one's home, acid at first, and each little globe of the berry too taut and distinct from the others, then they swell to hold the riot of their juices, and briefly the fat berries are perfected to my taste, and then they begin to leak and blob, and under their crescendo of sugar I can taste how they make it through winter. By the time I'm back from a last six-berry raid, it's almost dusk, and more mosquitoes will race around my ear, their tiny engines, the speedboats of the insect world. I won't be longer on the porch than it takes to look out once and see what I've taught myself in 2 months here to discern. Night restoring its opacities, though for an instant as intense and evanescent as waking from a dream of eating blackberries and almost being able to remember it, I think I see the parts. Haze, dusk, light broken into grains, fatigue, the mineral dark of the white mountains, the wavering shadows steadying themselves, separate, then joined, then seamless. The way, in fact, Frost's great poems, like all great poems, conceal what they merely know to be predicaments. However long it took to watch what I thought I saw, it was dark when I was done, everywhere and on the porch, and since nothing stopped my sight, I let it go.
Wow, that's beautiful. And that's by?
That's by William Matthews, one of the resident poets at the Frost Place. So it's just one example of how this place that fed Frost. I had a little quote about him from a letter that he sent one of his editors. He said, "Our summer was one of the pleasantest we have had for years. There is a pang there that makes poetry." So since 1915, this house and this land has been making poetry and encouraging poetry in others. And that's, I think, what we all love about it.
Well, that's wonderful. Patrick Donnelly, you have been talking with us here on Writer's Voice about the summer poetry programs at the Frost Place. It sounds really exciting, really wonderful. And again, if listeners are hearing this too late for this summer's programs, please do find out more about the Frost Place in time for next summer. And maybe we'll catch up with you again afterwards to get the lowdown on what happened.
Thank you so much. I'd love that.
Poet Patrick Donnelly. Go to writersvoice.net for a link to the Frost Place. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Be sure to visit us at writersvoice.net to find out who's coming on next week, listen to archive shows, and leave your comments and suggestions. That's www.writersvoice.net. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.